It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. What a day yesterday was. Hurricane Ida, what was left of it, made its way through here. Heavy, heavy downpour. In fact, the kids were talking about going and filling up the inflatable rafts and going down the street with the huge amount of water that was flowing like a river down the hill. And, you know, it was so bad that this is the weirdest thing. The school district actually canceled school yesterday in advance out of fear of rain, and a two-hour delay today out of fear of flooding. And look, the creek where we live by, really high. And it's one of those things where, you know, I'm grateful to live in an elevated spot, you know, on the good land. I feel sorry for the people who were down where it was flooded and in all of the places that were flooded. And it got me thinking today, because we were in New Orleans about a year and a half after Katrina. Things were still a mess, but they had gotten some things back together. And it's when the convention centers were starting to do conferences and stuff again. We were at the beginning of that. And I went down with a reporting group, and they had their conference there. And, you know, we got to go and do a whole bunch of stories about, you know, the cleanup and the recovery. And my focus was on what the unions were doing in New Orleans to help rebuild, and the union members on how they were affected. And, you know, it's just one of those things that I look at it and I go, you know, the lesson should have been learned right there. And you go, but Rick, that's, you know, once in a 100-year thing. And who knew that the levees were going to breach, and who knew that this was going to happen? Well, evidently they did, because, you know, they had a decade earlier predicted that eventually those levees would break and you would end up with New Orleans in this giant soup bowl of nasty. And what it was, and it's what stuck with me, and it was a conversation I had today that reminded me of the, you know, some of the people that we met when we were down in New Orleans after the hurricane. And, you know, there was one guy that sticks out in particular, because he was one of the people who was, you know, going around rescuing people off of rooftops. He was someone who was jumping in the water all the time, you know, pulling boats along behind him to bring, you know, rescue supplies to help bring people to better spots. And he said, look, you know, we were in the poor parish. You know, we were in I think it was Jefferson Parish is where, you know, a lot of the ugliness happened. This is where we were. And right there are these huge oil refineries, these big chemical companies, you know, all of this toxic stew. And he was telling the story of you know, those days, those weeks where, you know, you were on your own. And he said, you know, the water was, he did this, one of these things, there, the water was up to my chest. And he put it, pointed his hand to his chest. And you go, you know, he goes, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the water was this high. And I said, well, you know, he was just being, you know, are you sure it was that high and it wasn't, you know, lower or higher? He took off his shirt and there was a line where he was basically burned from that line all the way down his body. Looked like he was scarred for the entire bottom, you know, 80% of his body, because of the chemicals and the stuff that was in the water, this toxic stew that just stayed there, because they didn't have the ability to pump it out. And, you know, I remember back then going, I hope we learned the lesson. And now, fortunately, you know, the levees held. Fortunately, they didn't have it. We haven't had another Katrina-type event. But understand, our storms are getting worse. Our infrastructure is getting older, more outdated. And, you know, I was watching a clip on Fox News, And there was a moment where the guy who was the host, said, we're going to pull away from this press conference that they were having on the hurricane because it's getting political, he said. They're making this political with their so-called climate change. And I'm going, dude, the once every 100-year heat wave is now once every decade. The 100-year storm and flood is now happening every 10, 15 years. And it's going to get worse. These storms are going to get much worse, much bigger, much, much more aggressive. Have you seen the videos coming out of New York City of the subways that are literally, it looks like Niagara Falls in the subways as water is just pouring down the subways? Because we don't have the infrastructure to deal with that kind of a situation. But we better figure it out. We better start investing in how to make sure that our citizens are cared for and our infrastructure doesn't continue to fail us. In Mississippi, they had that, what was it, like a 60-foot round giant sinkhole open up and swallow, what was it, 7, 8 cars, 10 cars and a motorcycle, I think it was. A couple people got killed. I've been saying for a while, maybe we need to go, since everybody's on their phone all the time, somebody needs to develop an app. To say, hey, you're on a road that was, built in, during the Great Depression. The WPA built this road. The CCC built this road. This bridge is, 20 years outdated. Call home. Say goodbye to mom. You might not make it down the road. And we've got people who are going, well, we really need to not spend all that money on, infrastructure and stuff. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. And it just kind of blew my mind to hear this Fox guy go, well, we're going to pull away from this because they're getting political, talking about that climate change. And you go, how at this point can you deny it? How is it possible at this moment in history you can deny it? And look, the weather's going to get more extreme. We know that as the planet gets warmer. I'm no meteorologist. But I've talked to a few. It is a recipe for disaster. And here we are. And all we get, and this is the thing that bothers me, all we get from the Fox News is and the right-wing propaganda machine is, oh, it's all a hoax. It doesn't exist. It's not real. They're just making it political. Democrats better get their behinds moving because there's a lot of misinformation. The right-wing disinformation machine is working overtime. I mean, you look at what they've done with Afghanistan. First it was, they hate dogs. They left the dogs behind. Not one U.S. military dog was left behind. Not one. They left $83 billion of weapons and piles of cash for the Taliban to grab up. Trump and all his buddies and, the dumb Trumps. All those social media accounts, they're all lying. And there's no accountability for it. Because we didn't leave $83 billion worth of weapons behind. But again, the big lie. Lots of the big lie. We lost the war. Joe Biden lost the war because he pulled out. The old George Carlin joke. I say we keep it in there and get the job done. Dumbest thing ever. But here's the thing. The right-wing misinformation machine, their tactic is to continue to keep people enraged, hyper-raged, 24/7, 365, hyper-raged, foaming at the mouth, rabid, because it's what they do. So that the big lie, and the bigger the lie is, the more they believe. They left $83 billion worth of weapons. You go, do you know how much $83 billion is? And what the cameras pan to when they show what we left behind were a bunch of broken down things that we destroyed before we left. Because we didn't have room on the planes to get them out. Because, hey, we had to get people out. We had to get the U.S. service dogs out. Are you going to take the Black Hawk helicopter Are you going to take the tank? You're going to take all that stuff and shove it? No, you're going women and children first. Get the dogs and the soldiers out. Get the people out. Get them out. And they did an incredible job. But the right-wing lie machine, and again, the bigger the lie, the more their minions eat it up. The more outrage candy they get. We end up with a broken political system where you end up with a Texas who is now, thank you, Susan Collins, because evidently Susan Collins is disappointed. Susan Collins, who voted for all of the Supreme Court justices who have said, no, we don't care about women and their rights. She's now disappointed. Disappointed. Just disappointed. As she was disappointed about a couple of other things in the past where she's been wrong. And you know what's disappointing to me? That Maine didn't throw her out on her ear. Maine, you had the chance. So today, Joe Biden came out on the Supreme Court, said the Supreme Court's ruling overnight is an unprecedented assault on a woman's constitutional rights under Roe versus Wade. Which has been the law of the land for almost 50 years. Yes, they have overturned what has been almost 50 years of decided law, just like they did when the Janus decision overturned 40 years of labor law, making the entire country a no-rights-at-work country. Congratulations. And this is where Democrats, you better wake up, because all the stuff you ran on in 2020... protecting the right to vote, protecting a woman's right to choose, rebuilding the economy by strengthening unions and getting people's jobs, taking care of the virus, which you're doing the best you can on, and protecting workers' rights. You can't rerun on those in 2020. You have to accomplish them now. And this it starts with this most recent court decision. That has seriously set women back 100 years. Jerry Nadler, Judiciary Committee Chairman, said because the court has now shown regressive state legislatures how to game the system, the House Judiciary Committee will hold hearings to shine a light on the Supreme Court's dangerous and cowardly use of a shadow docket. Look, we knew that's what's going to happen all along. It's what they've done. There's no surprise here. Jen Psaki, press secretary, asked a male reporter, said, "I know you've never faced those choices, nor have you ever been pregnant. But for women out there who have faced those choices, this is an incredibly difficult thing. The president believes that right should be respected." But these guys don't. I mean, that's the weird part of all this. And I saw a video today of this crazy right-wing group that's basically a hotline for you to turn in your neighbor, for you to spy on your neighbor. And good on the people, seriously, good on the people of Texas and around the country for spamming the heck out of that number, basically shutting their site down and reporting everybody and anybody, because this is a joke. It's an absolute joke that a state is saying, hey, citizens, if you spy on each other and you bring us credible information and we put a woman in jail for having an abortion and all the people who helped her, the cab driver who took her, the mother who gave her money, the boyfriend who, you know, picked her up, the doctor who did it, the nurse who signed her in, if you turn them all in and give us all the details, all the gory seated details, so they can be alone at night by themselves with a box of Kleenex, we'll give you $10,000. We'll give you 10 grand. So we can turn citizens against one another. And look, everyone's going, well, where'd that come from? Why'd they do that? Huh? Who decided that? I know who did it. This was the boyfriend, the husband, the father. This was the person who's going to punish that woman for how dare she. This was about punishment. And this is about making sure that everybody looks down on this person and sees them as a profit motive. Now they say, oh, we're going to respect their privacy rights. What privacy rights are you talking about? How do you do that? Also weird. I happened to be looking up stories today, and I found a couple years ago that the state of Missouri, evidently checking on Planned Parenthood, was actually following women's cycles. You got the state looking at over women's shoulder. Evidently, these apps that you get, I didn't even know there were, but there are apps where you can follow whatever the monthly cycle thing is. They're following that. This is the kind of stuff that somebody's going to be tracking. They hack into your cell phone. They know this information. And, oh, if it doesn't come, we're turning you in. And the lawyers have got to be just thrilled. The amount of court cases this could for defending and prosecuting. Wow. Lawyer's wet dream. Now you got Kamala Harris saying that the decision is not the last word on Roe versus Wade. We'll not stand by and allow our nation to go back to the days of backroom abortions. We'll use every lever of our administration to defend the right to a safe and legal abortion, blah, 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 blah. Nancy Pelosi blahs on too. We're going to codify it into law. Merrick Garland said the Justice Department's deeply concerned. Do something about it. Don't talk about it. Do it. And pull Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema in and say, look, we'll sacrifice you. At some point, you've got to save your soul. At some point, you've got to stand and fight. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent, said a majority of justices have opted to bury their heads in the sand. I wholeheartedly disagree with the Supreme Court justice on this. This is why they were put there. We've known it all along. And for everyone who said, no, don't worry about it. They're just corporatists. And look, I'm one of them who said they are corporatists. But they were put there for this too. Because the corporatists want, well, they want desperation class workers. And what better way to keep people desperate? Pump them full of kids. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. And workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day the Protocol of Peace brought an end to the cloakmaker strike in New York City. The garment industry had been rocked by the uprising of 20,000 months earlier. Young women had struck hundreds of small shops over pay, recognition, and working conditions. They won ILGWU recognition in all but a handful of shops. 60,000 cloakmakers in the city were inspired to walk out of the sweatshops that July. The mostly male strike force demanded shorter hours and increased pay, the closed shop, and more. Union membership soared, and most of the small shops caved. The larger manufacturers would not, however, and by the end of the summer, the Protocol of Peace was negotiated. Future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis figured prominently in the negotiations. The protocol established higher wages, shorter hours, and overtime pay. It also guaranteed the union shop, elimination of contracting, and monitoring of piecework rates. Even more significant, workers won a union health center, a board of sanitary control, a board of grievances, and a board of arbitration. For the first time, garment workers had access to health care, a way to eliminate sweatshop conditions, and a way to mediate and resolve shop floor complaints. The price to be paid, however, was that workers would give up their most powerful leveraging tool, the right to strike. The agreement was lauded as a step forward for industrial democracy. But soon, many workers complained that the protocol failed to answer a number of shop floor issues. Grievances piled up, and workers were penalized when they attempted to strike to resolve their problems. The protocol would be scrapped for a return to militant strikes during the 1920s. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said earlier, these storms, they're going to get worse. And we need the investment now while we have the opportunity. We need to rebuild this country and to attempt to adapt to the storms that are coming, the kind of heavy rains we're going to get. I mean, look at New York City, crippled because its subway system is drowning. The roads, just underwater. I'm told this stuff is going to happen again and again, and it's going to happen more frequently. So we've got to make these investments now, which is why I'm a big fan of investing heavily in infrastructure. We could have done more with the bipartisan bill, but the Build Back Better plan, something we need to do. And here to share some thoughts on how we do some of that, I've asked Representative Andy Levin to come talk with us. Andy is on the House Education and Foreign Relations Committee. He's a representative for Michigan's 9th Congressional District. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you.
I appreciate you taking time for us. So have you seen these videos coming out of New York where it basically looks like Niagara Falls at every stop along the subway line?
I haven't seen them yet, but look, Rick, it just shows you the interconnection between infrastructure and climate change. You know, we have got to fix our roads and bridges and so forth, but we've got to get serious about climate change. The Build Back Better budget would be, if we can pass it as we're planning, it'll be by far the biggest intervention on climate change, in addition to doing a lot of important infrastructure and human infrastructure work too.
No, most certainly something we need. But, you know, I always point to the American Society of Civil Engineers, who say right now, today, as of this moment, Representative, we need $4.6 trillion. That's not what's being proposed for just our hard infrastructure, let alone our needs in everything else. So while I'm going, you know, this is historic investment, you know, the smart people, the people with the pencils and the slide rules, they're saying it's not near enough.
No, that's right. And I mean, they're talking about everything it would take to fix, you know, to get everything up to where it should be. So you don't have to do all that spending at once.
Right.
But I think we should be spending much more on this infrastructure. Rick, it's a great investment. And it's, you know, all that phony talk of supply side economics for all those years. Oh, just give rich people a tax cut and, you know, everybody will come out good. Well, that didn't happen. On the other hand, if you actually improve your infrastructure, make sure all poor kids, rural and urban, have broadband, right? Build out the infrastructure so that people can charge electric vehicles. They can buy the dang things because they could drive them wherever they want without running out of juice. Those kind of real investments really do help us in the long run because they make us more competitive. They create more jobs.
No, and look, the one of the big things that I point to, and look, I love the plan. I love the direction. I love the Buy American provision in here that says, hey, if we're going to rebuild these roads and bridges, we're going to use American steel and concrete. And we're going to use American workers. And for me, the fact that the Republicans weren't able to strip out prevailing wage laws out of it, this means that the workers doing those jobs are going to have good, solid, family-sustaining wage jobs, which is going to help everybody.
No question. I mean, we're now writing right into our bills the most aggressive pro-worker and pro-union language that you've ever seen. I mean, so for example, in my EV Freedom Act, which can't be in there exactly because it's a reconciliation package, so it can't have so much policy. But in the bill as I wrote it, there's neutrality in there, dude. If workers want to form a union, the boss is to get out of the way and let them decide on their own, right? We've got IBEW training standards, essentially, for electricians if they're going to, work on adding this kind of new vehicle electrification infrastructure.
As we should. I mean, they're the smart people. They're the ones who know how to do this stuff. We should let them do it.
Right. And, you know, as well as prevailing wage and all the health and safety provisions. So it's really important to make sure that we basically make everything we can in America and have it all made by well-paid union represented workers.
No, I'm right there with you. But here's a problem. You got Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who just came out today, said we need to take a pause on that big plan. Evidently too much in there he's not happy with. So how do we get that moved through? Because, look, everybody I talk to, when you start talking about nuts and bolts, getting kids college education, helping grandma get a new set of chompers and maybe a hearing aid, doing the human infrastructure stuff that does, like long-term care for people, all the stuff that we've needed for decades, everyone's for it. How do we get Joe Manchin and the rest of the party on board?
Well, you're right. I mean, of course, the problem is that we have the narrowest possible majority in the Senate. We need every single Democrat to vote for this, because let's remember, not one Republican will, not one. And it's almost the same in the House, though, Rick. I mean, right. You know, our majority is like 3 or 4, depending on the moment. So we are going to have to pass something that can get every single vote. And I don't know why some of these really conservative Democrats don't want to do super popular stuff that creates great jobs and makes America more competitive. But we're going to have to convince them, bring them along, package this up in a way that can get everybody's votes. We don't have a way around it.
Yeah, especially someone like Manchin, who, you know, a massive investment into West Virginia could turn that state somewhere in a positive direction. But here's the thing, and this is where I think the conventional wisdom is. If the Republicans can roadblock and stall and delay long enough, if we don't get something on infrastructure, if we don't get something on voting rights, it's going to be a long year in 2022 for Democrats. And I hear, you know, the former guy is about to announce he's going to run in 2024 here in a couple of days. So how do you do that?
Well, I think that, first of all, we have to realize that we did something massive with the American Rescue Plan, and we can't let that get lost in the shuffle. I mean, imagine every poor family, every working class family, middle class, way up into the upper middle class, every family is getting $250 a month or $300 a month for every kid. $250 if they're 6 or over, $300 a month if they're under 6. My wife and I remember the days when our oldest is 28 now, man. But I remember when we had 3 kids, 5 and under in the house, that would be $900 a month. I mean, that's transformative for working class or middle class families. And so we've got to keep that going. We improved, let's not forget, the Affordable Care Act significantly, made it way easier and more affordable for people to get coverage. We've got to keep that going. So I'm hopeful we can pass this full infrastructure and, human infrastructure bill to create jobs, cut taxes, and lower costs for people. And we're just going to have to duke it out internally to make sure we get everybody on board. I mean, whatever it takes.
Ultimately, as I've been saying for a while, we need to figure out how we pay for this stuff. And you do that by taxing the people who have been getting away with not paying taxes for decades. I'm sorry, we have a billionaire class that since the beginning of the pandemic until now saw their wealth go up 62%. Our billionaire class saw an extra $1.8 trillion lining their pockets while people are afraid that they're going to get evicted from their homes. It's time to start going passing the hat in that crowd. At least that's my view.
I mean, what if we just said, hey, you all were super billionaires before. Why don't we just start with that $1.6 trillion as a pay for? You know, but in all seriousness, we absolutely need to tax people. Billionaires should not be paying virtually no taxes, as we saw was revealed recently for you know, person after person paying no or virtually no taxes. Just outrageous. Secondly, corporations have to pay their share. And I really like what Janet Yellen is doing about trying to make sure, get a global compact to make sure all corporations globally pay at least 15% in taxes. But we've got to beef up the IRS to collect the taxes that people owe.
Yeah, great.
You and I pay our taxes, but if there's not enforcement from the IRS, some of these super rich people, get away with not even paying the taxes that they definitely do owe. So all that needs to happen.
Yeah, we got a lot of work ahead of us.
We can pay for a lot of this. with that. I got a cool way to pay for a little tiny bit of it.
Hit me.
We got to include the penalties from the PRO Act in here, which we plan to do, which will raise some revenue. So it works as for this, like reconciliation, because whatever you put in there has to either, you know, raise revenue or raise the deficit. And we have no meaningful penalties against employers when they violate workers' rights for trying to form a union, for, you know, demonstrating for a good contract, whatever. So if we include these penalties in there, that'll raise a little bit of revenue, but it'll also make it easier for workers to form unions. And that's a benefit in and of itself. So there's some things in there that are really important that will raise a little bit of revenue. And then I think we can raise a lot of revenue by increasing taxes on big corporations and the wealthiest.
No, I'm right there with you. But, you know, to your point on the fines for people who violate the labor laws, I've been saying for years, our labor laws are broken. The pendulum has swung way too far to the side of corporations, and we need something. And if it's just a little bit of, you know, a couple of fines, that's a help. But I still think we need major comprehensive overhaul to our labor law. Because, you know, employers have figured out how to get around them. All this misclassification, all of this independent contractor nonsense. We're now seeing Uber and Lyft spending another couple hundred million dollars in Massachusetts to do what they did in California. The moneyed interests, I don't know that a couple of fines are really going to hurt the big boys, because Amazon spent $200 million to keep workers from organizing in Alabama. In freaking Alabama.
Dude, I was there. You know, you're totally right. The PRO Act is my number one priority in Congress. And it's funny you should mention it, because I was just out in an event in Macomb County, and the national leader of the Young Dems Labor Caucus is one of my constituents, Rob Szymborski. And he was there showing me pictures about all their activism about on the two senators from Arizona and the one from Virginia, who are, you know, say they won't co-sponsor. Now I heard that Senator Warner says he's on board or something. Anyway, people need to hit the street. They need to get creative. We all need to tell stories. Like, think about this Nabisco strike that's going on right now. What a great, everybody knows about Oreos and whatever else they make, right? Well, you know, one of the things the PRO Act does that was barred since 1947, it's Taft-Hartley amendments, is let workers just act in solidarity with workers from another company. Yep. I mean, that's basic, the most basic freedom of expression should be a First Amendment right, right? So the Nabisco strike is a great example, right? Because everybody knows about Oreos and all those products that they have. So it would be huge if we passed the PRO Act when, you know, truckers or other workers from another company could say, no, I'm not crossing that picket line. And my job's not going to be at stake either, because I have a right to act in solidarity with workers in another company, because there's such a thing as working people sticking together. I mean, that's what has been lost in this country. And that's why the PRO Act is so important.
Yeah, it's one of those things that absolutely I'm in favor of. And, you know, I, in talking about the Nabisco strike, I love the fact that the train operator refused to deliver the flour because he was not going to, under any circumstances, cross a picket line. We got to go back to that. I mean, at the end of the day, I think we have to go back to, it still comes down to you and me and the working class people in this country saying, you know, we've had enough and we're going to act in solidarity with one another.
100%. And, you know, you're seeing it really hopeful signs all around if the politicians could just catch up to the people. I mean, look at all the workers in like the tech industry and the like digital media and stuff forming unions. You can't even keep up with all of it, really. Yeah. There are many groups that are forming unions, and we just need like working class service workers to be able to form a union without getting their chops busted. But that, you know, the way the labor law is now, if you're a restaurant chain or a hotel chain or, you know, any big company, Walmart, of course, example number one, right? You can prevent your workers from forming union through legal and illegal means, and there's basically no consequence to it.
And this is why I like that you're talking about fines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that they're not a cure-all. But if you put big, these are serious fines, you know, multiple damages, possibilities for punitive damages, and escalating fines for repeat offenses and stuff. So I think it really would affect company behavior on organizing campaigns. Maybe not an Amazon, but, you know, a lot of companies, I think it would.
Yeah, I would love to see that go into a nationwide strike fund, like an unemployment benefit for people who are on strike or locked out. That would be something interesting. So I guess last line of questioning, how do we get people motivated to contact their representatives and push this? Because ultimately it's going to come down to a vote, which now, as I said, Joe Manchin said he wants to put a pause on, which is a struggle for me because I don't think we get anything then.
Well, we don't. I mean, I hate that Joe Manchin suddenly has all this power. People, you know, say he does, but it is true that every single Democratic senator has to vote for whatever emerges. And we have very little time. So I'd encourage people to act right now. Here's the thing. If you want dental and vision and hearing, like hearing aids, to be covered in Medicare, get on your dang phone and call your senator or representative. Write a letter, send an email. If you want childcare for, you know, available and pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds so that kids can get a great start and parents can go to work, get on your dang phone. If you want free community college, this is my America's College Promise Act. It's in this bill. So, you know, if we end up having to cut the money, Rick, I figure we'll just not be able to do as much of these things. But this is the most transformative piece of legislation in decades. Because it covers so many things, it's probably the biggest thing, even bigger than anything in the war on poverty, because it covers a lot of things. Imagine if child care and pre-K workers were treated like teachers and were able to have unions and were made a middle-class wage, you know. So this is, yep, this would be huge for the working people of this country.
No, it's kind of like a reset button to undo some of the damage over the last 40 years of supply side voodoo Reaganomics and moving us back to where we had a social compact and we were kind of helping each other out, making college more affordable, college more affordable, healthcare more accessible, and an infrastructure that actually, benefits us. We got a lot to do, and I hope folks will reach out and contact you and others to make sure it gets done. But Representative Levin, I appreciate the time. As always, great talking with you, and please keep up the fight for labor.
You got it, Rick. Good to see you again. Take care of yourself.
You as well. Thanks so much, our good friend, Representative Andy Levin. Make sure you check out his website, andylevin.house.gov. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day that President Gerald Ford signed the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. The act was passed over growing concern about the mismanagement of private pension plans in the country. In 1963, the Studebaker Corporation closed its auto plant. Its pension plan was a mess. Nearly 7,000 workers received only 15% of their pension or nothing at all. Across the country, more and more workers were relying on private pensions. In 1960, 21.2 million workers had private pensions. By 1970, the number stood at 30 million. The funds in those pension plans had nearly tripled in that same decade to $138 billion. Ensuring the security of those pensions was essential for millions of workers and the stability of the economy. At the bill signing, President Ford explained, quote, "Dramatic growth in recent years has thrust private pension plans into a central role in determining how older Americans live in their retirement years. Yet, this same growth in pension plans has brought with it a host of new problems. Many workers have ultimately lost their benefits, even after relatively long service, because when they left jobs, they thereby gave up rights to hard-earned pension benefits. Others have sustained hardships because their companies folded with insufficient funds in the pension plan to pay promised pensions. In addition, some pension funds have been invested primarily for the benefit of the companies or plan administrators, not for the workers. It is essential to bring some order and humanity to this welter of different and sometimes inequitable retirement plans within private industry. President Ford signed the bill on Labor Day and outlined minimum standards for private pensions.
Hey, podcast fans, have you heard about MSW Media? It's your one-stop shop for some of the best progressive voices in the business. At MSWmedia.com, you'll find shows like Justice Matters with Glenn Kirshner, The Bureau with Frank Figluzzi, shows with hosts like Greg O'Lear and Zeb Shalev, and of course, Renato Mariotti, just to name a few. One of our personal favorites, The Daily Beans with Dr. Allison Gill. And of course, you can get The Rick Smith Show there too. Go to MSWmedia.com for all these great shows and more. And help us push back against the right-wing hate machine, one download at a time.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, the United Steelworkers kicked off their We Supply America bus tour. They kicked off in Burns Harbor, Indiana, went all the way across Ohio into Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, all talking about, hey, we need to build things here. We need to manufacture stuff. If we're going to rebuild our country, if we're going to build back better, we got to do it with American products and American workers. And here to share some thoughts and highlight this We Supply America bus tour, I've asked Roxanne Braun to come talk with us. Roxanne's an international vice president there with the United Steelworkers. Roxanne, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be with you.
So why kick off in Burns Harbor, Indiana? I don't think most people can find Burns Harbor, Indiana. What's there?
Well, what's there is local 6787, where we have steelworker members every single day working at Cleveland Cliffs, making the steel that goes into a lot of our infrastructure systems. Beyond our infrastructure systems, that steel also goes into some of our weapon systems as well. But this campaign is about how steelworker members supply America. And we thought the best place for us to kick that off would be at the House of Steel at 6787 Cleveland Cliffs in Indiana. And it was a great event.
No, I saw the video, and I saw Secretary Walsh, Department of Labor Secretary Walsh speak. I saw, the Congressman Marvin speak. My good friend Scott Paul spoke there as well. It was a well-received event. Lots of people, good crowd of workers, and people looking proud of the products that they make. And I think we should be doing a lot more of this. I'm glad you guys are doing this, but this is something we should be doing all the time, highlighting the fact that our workers make some of the best products in the world.
Absolutely. And, I've been saying that this campaign and what we called it, We Supply America, is a bit of a battle cry, to be honest. I think oftentimes when people think about infrastructure, because that's really what we're talking about with this campaign, they think about the folks who build the bridges and the roads and such, which is just as important, but they forget about the supply chain and the people who are supplying the parts and the components that go into these systems, our infrastructure systems. And so this is really our battle cry, that steelworker members across the country, including in Burns Harbor, provide the products and the components, whether it's steel, cement, brick, rubber, glass, chemicals, because coatings is a thing. All of these parts supply all of these systems that are so critical that help to run a nation. We Supply America. It's our battle cry now.
Absolutely. And not just, supply the things we need, but maintain communities with good paying jobs that allow a community to thrive. And when the factory closes, We know what happens. You know, opioid addiction goes up, poverty goes up, all of the horrible things. So for me, the idea of reinvesting in manufacturing, reinvesting in our supply chain, which has been, you look at what's happened over this pandemic, it's been magnified how broken our supply chain is. This is the exact time we need to be talking about this.
Exactly. And to that point, you know, today was stop number four for us in Danville, Virginia, and we were at local 831L, which is a Goodyear local. And our folks at that facility make bus, truck, and aviation tires. So that's our transportation infrastructure. But to your point about how these jobs and these facilities sustain a community, Goodyear is the largest private employer in Danville, Virginia. If that facility were to be not there anymore, it would be devastated. The jobs that sustain not just the families, but help to lend to the tax base in that community, to help to make sure that there are schools and libraries and hospitals, it would be gone. And so, you know, we wanna make sure that what we do with this campaign is to help push what's happening in Washington over the finish line. So that that type of investment that you just mentioned is happening and continues to happen in facilities like Goodyear and U.S. Steel and Cleveland Cliffs and Corning and other facilities where USW members work around this country every day.
No, I mean, you know, my entire life, you know, we've always kind of puffed up our chest a little bit and say, you know, we're the global leader in manufacturing. In fact, if you ever been to Trenton, New Jersey, there's a bridge there in Trenton that says Trenton makes, the world takes. Sadly, that I can't say that definitively as we once could in the past, because we've allowed companies to move overseas or to China or wherever. And this infrastructure bill for me is an opportunity, I think, to kind of maybe reset some of that. The fact that Joe Biden has said we have to have very strong Buy American provisions, and we're going to rebuild our country with American-made products that are going to create American jobs, seems to me to be kind of a reset to move us back towards, well, you know, what my grandparents' generation built, the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization.
I totally agree. And just so you know, Rick, I'm a New Yorker. I'm from New York. So I know that bridge in Trenton well. And I know that slogan very well. And it really does capture a lot of what we've seen across our sectors in the steelworkers. You know, unfortunately, we've become intimately aware and well-versed in trade policy because we've had to, use our trade policies to help ensure that there's a level playing field for our workers and their industries over the years. And you're right that, you know, this $1.2 trillion infrastructure package for physical infrastructure is a huge, once in a generation, really, investment in infrastructure with $600 million of new spending. That's huge. That's something that we've been calling for a long time.
Decades, Rocks. You know, I've been saying it for the last couple of days. It was 14 years ago that the I-35 bridge collapsed. And it was a decade before that we were talking about we need to invest in infrastructure. So while $1.2 trillion sounds like a lot of money, the fact that we've neglected our infrastructure this long means that it's really not. And we need considerably higher. In fact, you know this as well as anyone. The American Society of Civil Engineers puts that price tag somewhere around, if I'm not mistaken, $4.6 trillion. Not 1.2, exactly, but $4.6 trillion. And that's just to get to about a B, B minus, not even to A grade.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. Infrastructure has been the meat that Congress has left on the table for decades, as you say. And so that's why we have this campaign, We Supply America, to really try to, again, push as much as possible and support this effort that is working its way through Congress, not just the $1.2 trillion package, but that $3.5 trillion package for the social and human infrastructure that is just behind it, because it's not just about making the things, it's about the people who support a nation. You know, you mentioned the pandemic. We're still in this 18-month period. We saw what happened when we have a social and human system that is not supported, that system cannot effectively support a nation. And so these two packages together for us, critical to get over the finish line, necessary for the American public, necessary for American workers, necessary for American industry, and necessary for American communities.
No, something we most certainly need. And over the next couple of days, you're going to be traveling around. And Friday, you're going to end up in Pittsburgh. Tomorrow, you're going to end up Thursday in North Carolina. If people want to follow along, see where you've been, what you're talking about, uswvoices.org is the website. uswvoices.org, the website. Now you're doing this to raise awareness, and that's great. We need that to happen. What are you hoping comes out of this? You know, we're going to have these great events, and I'm a big fan of events. I'm a big fan of bus tours and all of that stuff. But what are we hoping to gain on the other side come Monday when people go back to work and the bus has been parked? What are we hoping to grab?
I think a couple of things. You know, a big part of this campaign is education. Whenever you do a bus tour or anything like that, it's about education. And again, on the first piece, education is for policymakers so that they can make a very clear connection to steelworker jobs, I'll say USW jobs and infrastructure, because oftentimes when people think of our union, they really just think about steel because we are, that's our name. But
you
really
represent
wanna,
nurses. You
we
represent everybody.
Nurses. We represent school bus drivers. We represent folks at American Water. We represent folks at National Grid. So it's not just the components and the things that are going into these systems that I talked about, but it's the folks who are servicing these systems too that we represent. And so this is an education about the full scope of the steelworkers. I've been saying it's our commercial for our union about all of the work that steelworker members do every day. So the first piece is hoping that policymakers make the connection to how many jobs are connected to this bill so that they see that it has to get done. Secondly, we want our members to know when they hear infrastructure, when they hear policymakers talking about this bill, when they hear you, Rick, or others in the news talking about this bill, that they know that it's their jobs that are being discussed. And third, we want victory. You know, come fall, we want to be one of the ground troops that help to secure victory and make sure that we have both of these bills passed and ultimately signed by President Biden.
No, and we desperately need it. And not just from the political side. I mean, the political side, the Democrats do absolutely need this to pass if they're going to be competitive in 2022. But as a country, we desperately mm-hmm. need this. You know, mm-hmm. For years I've been saying, someone should do an app for people's phone that every time they go over a structurally deficient bridge, it sends a notification saying, hey, call mom. You might not make it to the other side. But I made that joke 15 years ago. So we're in this moment where we desperately need it. So let me ask you, as someone who pays a lot of attention to this, what do you think the chances of both bills passing? Do you see maybe one or the other or both? How do you see the jockeying of getting this through happening?
You know, I will say a lot depends on what happens now that the Senate bill has gone over to the House. I think Speaker Pelosi has been pretty clear about the path forward that she wants for these bills, that she wants, she will not move one without the other. And again, it's because she recognizes how critically important each of these pieces are. We never thought about social infrastructure before COVID. Never thought about it because we never had to think about
right.
it. We only thought about the physical infrastructure, like you said, the bridges that are deficient, the dams, the locks, all of these things, the rivers that need to be all. We never thought about the social infrastructure. We can't not think about it now.
Well,
so I think because of that, it's clear that both of them have to move. And so I have a lot of faith in the speaker. She's tough.
Yeah, I hope both of them. I hope they do both move because we desperately need them. But I might push back a little bit on the fact that we never thought about social infrastructure. I think we did. I mean, I grew up, politically during the Reagan years, and the construct of anyone getting help through the social compact, the welfare queen and the poor small family farmer who lost his farm because of the estate tax. We did focus on social infrastructure, but we were focused on destroying it.
That's
and
right.
it's now when more people actually needed it and realized how insufficient it really is that now I think we have a different viewpoint. And I think it's a good thing.
I agree. I definitely agree. I like your nuance there. And I think the same thing applies to the supply chain, because the supply chain and the loss of domestic manufacturing is something that our union has been talking about since the 80s. But again, this period when we saw that we didn't domestically have the PPE to help our nurses and our doctors, Americans had an aha moment that, holy crap, we've sold our industries to other nations. We make nothing here.
That's it.
So I think this whole period has been an awakening. And I think it's been a rejiggering of the way that we think about these concepts of social infrastructure and supply chains and the need for them. So, you know, I think the pressure that we're still in, because now we all thought that we were emerging from this thing. Now we're in a new phase with Delta. I think that will put additional pressure to make both of these bills actually move through Congress. And so we'll see, you know, they'll be back in the fall. They'll be back in a couple of weeks here in September. We'll see what happens. You know, but I think we have a lot of hope that this process will work its way through, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure that it happens.
Yeah, hope, but fight. Last question I've got for you, and I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, will parts of the PRO Act be in this infrastructure? Is it going to remain there? I know they can only do probably some economic parts, but we desperately need people to be able to join and form unions, because I think there's an aha moment here for working people right now, that they saw how vulnerable they were. That now maybe this is the time that we see an explosion of organizing and people joining and forming unions, if only we had laws that were helpful.
I think it remains to be seen. You know, I think there certainly is a massive campaign that the AFL-CIO was engaged in. And, you know, to his credit, and God rest his soul, Rich Strumka, I mean, was the champion of the PRO Act and pushing the PRO Act as hard as we possibly can, and through Congress, and ultimately hopefully getting it signed into law. We'll see. I think it remains to be seen how this process unfolds, but I do think it's telling that this administration included it in the American Jobs Plan, which was this administration's infrastructure plan, that it said that the right to organize is a critical piece of this nation's infrastructure. It meant that family sustaining jobs are a critical piece of this nation's infrastructure. And so, we joined with our brothers and sisters in labor to continue to ask Congress to include it in this package. And I think it remains to be seen what happens.
Yeah, I'm hoping, and I've been pushing as much as I can, because I do see that if we could get some reform, and I don't think we're going to get everything in the PRO Act, but at least something that's going to help a little bit, that it's going to give us a fighting chance. Sadly, if we don't, I fear if nothing comes of it, this opportunity may pass, and we may be, well, we may be left behind. And that's the thing that's concerning me. As much of a pro-union president as Joe Biden is, and I love that fact about him, if we don't change the laws, it's going to be very difficult for us.
We 1,000% agree with you, Rick.
But again, I hope folks will check the website. Make sure you follow the bus tour, the We Supply America bus tour done by the United Steelworkers. Go to uswvoices.org. We'll get links out on social media on how you can follow along. Roxanne, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Always great stuff you guys do. Get out there and keep spreading the word, and solidarity to your members.
Thank you so much, Rick. Thanks for having me on. Have a great night.
You too. Thanks so much. Again, Roxanne Brown, International Vice President of the U.S. Steelworkers, uswvoices.org, the website. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. The talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in 2 segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible, 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.